Locked On Lakers podcast. I'm Anthony Irwin. I'm joined by Pete Zayas. Pete, the Team USA Celtics / Pops lost.
How did you? I'm feeling very Russian about it. I am delighting in the failures and the chaos created on Team USA by Celtics and Popovich. Wait, is this the year we're going to have the Popovich, the games past Popovich by conversation? I've been waiting for that.
Can I be honest?
Huh.
So the Dodgers are this to a less, much lesser extent, right? Where the attainable goal is mediocrity. Right. In the NBA, you can be mediocre and make the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
So the attainable goal is mediocrity.
Yes.
And I feel like that's what the Spurs' goal has been, like, for the last long time. And
absolutely.
This is what separates to me teams that are vying for championships and teams that are shooting for mediocrity, is that you can be mediocre with, like, your coach being the number one name on your ticket, right? You can be mediocre. You could set the culture. You could be consistent. You can be all the things that the boring ass Spurs are, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually want to figure into the title conversation, you get, like, Pop can't be, like, the thing. Pop's culture, right. Like Spurs culture, that can't be the thing. And, you know, the Dodgers are kind of figuring this out too, where it's not that they aim for mediocrity, but they definitely cling pretty tightly to those division titles, right? They've won 7 in a row now,
mm-hmm.
which you can do if in a sport that you can spend a ton of money on and you're that far ahead of the teams that are in your division, right? Like the San Francisco Giants went for it all for a really long time, and now they're revitalizing, they're retooling, right? The mm-hmm. Arizona Diamondbacks just suck. The Padres just suck. And so, like, you can be mediocre. And not that the Dodgers are mediocre. They're really, really good this year.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's that, like, they're not the Spurs, right?
No.
The Spurs are a low playoff seed,
right?
Have for the last few years,
and so, like, this thing with Pop and whether or not the game has kind of passed him up, I think it's that the idea of Pop was always really illogical to me. In the NBA, like, if he was in a college kind of program, if he was running a college program, they'd be a dynasty, maybe the best dynasty in college sports ever, because that's what he's done. He's set a culture, and he gets people that fit into that culture, and they do their amount of winning that it takes to do the amount of winning that fits their expectations. But, like, this idea that he, like, putting him side by side with Phil Jackson, I just don't see it. Phil Jackson won with superstars. He got his superstars. He got Michael Jordan to fit into a team concept. He got Kobe to fit into a team concept. He got Shaq too. He got all these guys to be able to fit into that team construct. And Pop, I think, kind of lucked out with, like, the perfect superstar. Tim Duncan was, like, perfect for that kind of a situation. He was willing to take less. He had no personality, so it was perfectly. He was never going to rub teammates the wrong way, and Pop, you know, just made that happen. And even he got in his own way when he took Duncan off the court for that one rebound that Ray Allen hit the jumper on.
Yeah, I mean, let's not act like Phil Jackson wasn't very lucky. And, like, the times when Popovich has been good when they've had superstars, right? Just like any other coach. Mm-hmm. And that kind of speaks to your point,
but
right?
I mean, like the idea that superstars.
Sure, sure. But again, Phil, like, what does Popovich do with Shaq and Kobe or MJ and Pippen? There's no way to know.
Bronze medals.
But it it speaks to the, like, to the whole point of, like, look, it's Popovich is great. You can make the argument that he's the greatest coach of all time, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an argument, at least. He's in the conversation. But if you don't have the horses, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And, if you don't have the dudes, it just doesn't matter. And this team combined with, at this point, Popovich has become one of the great things about Popovich and that he's been able to do for a long time, but he stopped doing a couple of years ago, is that he adapted to like the new style. As the game changed, he would change too. And now he's been, the last couple of years, he's seemed to be this like very middle finger, like, I'm going to run my motion weak, my motion strong, all of my sets that I love. And yeah, the analytics say the mid-range isn't great, but if that's the best shot, that's the shot that we're going to take. I know more about basketball than all of you combined. And that, to me, that is the thing I delight about the most in a Celtics Spurs failure for Team USA, is the Celtics, not necessarily these players, but the people who cover the Celtics, you know, nationally in particular, and just the perception of them, is that they are smarter. Danny Ainge and Brad Stevens, they've figured out this system better than anybody else has. And then Popovich, very much the whole like way he acts in post-game press conferences stopped being charming to me a while ago, where it's like, oh, you're just
dickish,
really just being a dick, right? Yeah, and like people will ask totally fair questions, and like it's one thing if someone asks a dumb question, they clown on them a little bit. It might not be the nicest thing, but it's understandable. But like, yo, like you have got no place to be acting like that when you lost. Like this team still has more talent than anybody else in the world.
It does. People are acting like it was this up and coming, you know, basically like a bunch of Rudies out there. It wasn't. It was still far and away the most talented team out there. There were other teams that had higher level talent, like Giannis was on a team, Nikola Jokic, I believe they just lost to, right? Like, but the other thing that you hear all the time about FIBA play is, well, some of that individual talent is kind of stymied by the rules and the setting of that style of play anyway. So if that's the case, then that star level talent shouldn't matter as much. It should be the better all around team, which Team USA was, right? And now I do think the one thing that Team USA is always going to run up against if the talent is close, which I think it was close. We're closer, right? If the talent is closer, those guys that are playing on these different countries, there's only a handful of really, 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 really good ones anyway. So they've like grown up playing alongside each other in that national team setting. These guys have never played together. So like
there's more cohesion on those teams.
Yeah. That's the one disadvantage that you can talk about. But if you're talking, if your head coach is this grand culture setter that is Greg Popovich, then he didn't do his job. Right?
Yeah. Absolutely right. Like that's part of the value of that, is that he can, you know, get guys rowing in the same direction. But you got all these guys who aren't used to playing in motion offense type of, and then some of the roster decisions. De'Aaron Fox probably should have been on that team. Kuz would have really helped this squad, especially their lack of bigs. And international play is a little different in terms of bigs, in that like smaller guys are more. Like Kuz at the five is less crazy when you're playing internationally than you are in the NBA. They made some poor roster decisions. They probably need some new blood in there, just in general, in terms of leadership from Colangelo to Popovich.
Colangelo's involved. I want to continue talking about this because it's interesting to me. One of the things that we talked about in Locked On NBA, I just finished recording that show about an hour ago with Dave DuVore. You guys should check that out. But one of the things we talked about was, is FIBA at fault for some of this stuff? Like Americans seem to take the lion's share of the blame as far as where's the superstar talent out there. But it's not like FIBA did anybody any kind of favors here, right? So I want to talk about whether we think FIBA as a governing body here set themselves up for failure with how they put this tournament together. So let's hang tight. We'll come back to that here in a second. So what narratives pop up? We aren't in charge of that. We have no idea I have no idea where that's going to go. Sometimes you can kind of predict how some of this is going to go. Like because Greg Popovich was the coach, the level of talent on this team was the focus, right? But if Phil Jackson was the coach, I'm sure we wouldn't be, Donovan Mitchell would be, you know, some future Hall of Famer, right? That's just the benefit that Pop has built with the relationships he has with the people who decide on narratives. But when it comes to FIBA, I want to focus on FIBA itself, because the team that we sent out there, it's hard to get me to be interested in basketball at 4 a.m. anyway. it's not the kind of thing that you know, in September, I'm going to be working my tail off to watch anyway, right? But I'm definitely not going to watch a team where Donovan Mitchell is one of the better, like maybe the best or one of the better players on the team, right? Okay. And if I'm FIBA, because the thing that they're trying to do right now is make the FIBA World Cup the basketball equivalent of the World Cup, right? That's kind of their aim, but they're working from behind because it's this brand new thing that they're trying to create on the fly. And I don't think the people who are in charge of this tournament get nearly enough criticism for the time of year that they put this thing on. Why would any NBA player play in this thing? You're asking an NBA player to fly to China 2 or 3 weeks before their training camp kicks off?
What would you do? Would you move it up?
I'd move it up
3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah, no. I'd move it up maybe 2 or 3 weeks, because 3 or 4, because then you got the training camps for this thing, and you're running up against the end of, you know, free agency and that stuff. But I'd move it up like 2 or 3 weeks, and I would set some kind of a rule where if you don't at least show up for camp, so like Jerry Colangelo had a quote today where he said, "I'm going to remember who turned us down," right?
Right.
And you know, I kind of made fun of it because it's like, oh, well, LeBron didn't go, therefore Jerry Colangelo is going to stand him up for the World Cup or for the Olympic team. That's definitely going to happen, right? But if I say, hey, I just want so-and-so superstars to at least, you know, show up to like one game or training camp or something, be associated with this thing early on in the process in order to be able to be eligible for the Olympics down the line, because that's the actual trophy that actually matters. So if you move it up and you get these superstars at least involved in the early going on, you get some casual fans who, at least at the beginning, you know, they'll be interested in watching LeBron and Paul George and Anthony Davis and Kawhi Leonard and all these guys at least involved in the beginning of it. And then as those guys drop off, if they drop off, you've actually watched a couple of these players and grown invested in some of these players and see what you can do to get more interest, at least from the beginning in this tournament. That, like, it's wild. We are in the doldrums of the NBA season. People who love basketball were not interested in this thing. People who, like, deeply care about this sport were just like, oh, okay.
Is that just a matter of timing? Like, do you think that the poor attendance is just when it is during the – because, I mean, this is not – terribly. Usually the Olympics are in July, I think. And I expect that to be more well attended by NBA players than this was. But there are a lot of, you know, there's world championships and now this FIBA World Cup, which I think, you know, which is different. The schedule isn't that different than previous years. Like, there got to be some other factors involved in the reason why this was so poorly attended by the best players in the game, right?
Everybody hates Pop. No, I'm kidding.
No, it's that actually got me thinking.
I don't think people want to work with Colangelo, Jerry Colangelo.
But the players don't really directly work with Colangelo.
Yeah,
that
I know,
but I do think Popovich is a basketball ideologue. He has very, and for good reason, a man with that resume and who knows that much about basketball, has good reason to be like, no, you're going to do it my way.
Right.
But that is dying in the NBA. He's one of the last coaches.
So you're rolling with this.
That can really – no, I actually think there's – I wouldn't say they hate Popovich. Yeah. Popovich is enormously respected, and I know you said that tongue-in-cheek anyway. Yeah. But like is – think of a star player that skipped this. You know, say Kevin Durant's hurt. But yeah, LeBron's fine. Or let's say Anthony Davis, right? Mm-hmm. Is AD really going to like – spend a couple weeks getting yelled at by Popovich for not setting the correct down screen on a zipper cut and then not running his motion weak properly? Like, it's just a different style of basketball. It was interesting when you brought up the college aspect of things, like Popovich, like, is one of the most successful NBA coaches of all time. But that, I have a iron grip over this program.
It's a college concept.
It's a college thing, right? And the Spurs are really the only team in the NBA I can think of where the coach has that type of culture. And they play basketball a certain way. And they're good. They make the playoffs every year. These are not bad teams. But if you're a star player, like, is this really how you want to spend 3 weeks? Especially when, like, we talk about representing your country and all that, but it's not the Olympics. We don't view, as Americans, we don't view these competitions the way that a lot of the rest of the world does. Yeah. I can't speak to the FIBA World Cup, but, like, the World Championships is a big deal elsewhere in the basketball world. For us, it's like, yeah, it's the thing between Olympics, right?
For me, I looked at it as like, hey, basketball in September, that's fun.
Yeah, it's something, right? And, you know, you flip it on. I got a little trial ESPN Plus so I could watch some of the games from this tournament because I'm bored. I miss basketball and I want to watch it. So, yeah, there's also, from a marketing and promotion standpoint, they don't do a very good job of capitalizing on what you're talking about there. That whole concept of, hey, we're bored and we've got some basketball to watch.
Yeah, I felt like I walked away from this experience, you know, one. So basically, look, I wasn't out and out rooting against this team the way that it appeared on Twitter, right?
Sure.
That wasn't, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't watching that French game and being like, Viva France, you know, like I wasn't rooting for Rudy Gobert. I don't, you know, that wasn't what I was doing. It was more of like a, all right, this thing happened. It's a bummer that Team USA lost. It's funny that the Celtics and Greg Popovich played a central role in that. Like, that's funny to me. Mm-hmm. But I more than anything, I walked away from this like, man, that felt like a miss for FIBA. Man, this really, like, this whole thing felt like something that should have been a bigger deal than it was. And, you know, I think America played a role in that. I think Canada played a role in that because there's some good Canadian players who didn't go. I think FIBA, though, shouldn't skate by on criticism because the timing of it was funky. The location of it made it really difficult for a good chunk of a lot of the teams who were playing in this thing, their fan bases to watch, right? So, you know, I not to say that, you know, we shouldn't host things in China. I'm just saying if you really want this thing to be the focal event that you want it to be, if you really want to build it as big as FIBA seems to want to build this thing, I just think they missed on way too many things. And everybody walked away from this when it should have been, like I said, basketball in September when nothing else is going. You want me to watch the Dodgers on a nightly basis? Like, I can't do that. So, like, if FIBA gave me something that was a more watchable product, then I think it would have been a lot more interesting. It would have been a lot more fun for something a lot closer to what this should have been.
I mostly agree with you. I think I lay more of the blame on the USA basketball leadership than you might, but we're on the same page.
Yeah. There's plenty of blame to go around because it was a big miss. It just came and went, and here we are. All right, we're going to take a quick second here. When we come back, we're going to open up the mailbag. We have a few fun questions here to get us caught up and ready for the weekend. So hang tight. We'll come back and we'll talk about... let's tease this. You ready for a super radio tease? Coming up after the break, we'll find out if these Lakers, how they match up against the 2010 champion Los Angeles Lakers.
Oh, Lord. This is the most off-season question ever.
I don't know how radio people do it. I felt like such a goober saying that.
I'll talk to you after the show. I talked to someone today about this whole, like, what the hell do we talk about right now?
Yeah.
Issue that we're all dealing with, and they cracked me up. I will share later.
All right. So let's start here. Nick A29. I answered this question in part in a different direction. I just said, so the question is, after LeBron leaves/retires, what's the long-term plan for the Lakers? Get free agents or rebuild around AD? And my answer was basically, don't worry about it right now. Enjoy this, because when that happens, you're going to look back and say, hey, it would have been fun to enjoy the really fun basketball that we might have in front of us. Mm-hmm. But to answer the actual question, how do you think the Lakers move forward?
The Lakers structured all of the contracts to end when LeBron can opt out of his contract, mm-hmm. which almost certainly will do, which doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to leave, but he's got this year and the following year guaranteed, and then a player option for a year after that. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, there are two different routes. There, ideally, you know, you've got Anthony Davis locked up. You signed him this offseason. You've got him under contract and then a bunch of cap space. Mm-hmm. In that particular offseason, Giannis is the big free agent, and obviously that's who the Lakers would love to pursue. But you've got several other guys who are really good. Beal is a free agent. You know, a lot of them are older. I think Harden will be 33 that summer and older, but still probably very good. So I think that's the preferred route that the Lakers take and try to get at least one more other guy and then fill out the roster. And basically you either replace LeBron. I'm curious if LeBron would take a discount, right, so that he could get another ring. That is when guys do take a discount. That is the portion of their career in which they do that. And also LeBron's not normal in that 2 years from now, I don't know if he'll still be a top 10 player in the NBA, but he's still going to be really good, barring some sort of catastrophic injury. So, you know, it's not like his value will be nothing. You'll have his bird rights. So I think that's plan A for sure. Then the plan B is the rebuild all over again, right? Say you don't get any of those guys, Giannis or Beal or anybody who's available that is worth it, isn't interested in coming. At that point, do you consider cashing in AD and sending him somewhere and getting some of the picks and assets back that the Lakers lost mm-hmm. in pursuing him in the first place, right? Like, I don't think you want to, like, tread water with AD. You don't want to do what the Pelicans did for 7 years and be, like, okay, mm-hmm. right? So those are the two clear paths that I see ahead, and I think that they would strongly prefer the former.
It's going to be interesting to watch over the next couple seasons the rumors that come out of, like, all-star breaks and summers. Like, who is Anthony Davis hanging out with? What's his focus on? Who's he particularly close with in those settings when other NBA superstars are nearby, right? Because that, I think, will start to give us a little better picture of what the Lakers' chances at landing somebody alongside Anthony Davis. Because he's not the kind of player that other superstars are going to go out of their way to play with. That could change. But as of right now, he doesn't seem like that kind of a guy.
In LA, I actually disagree with you on that, because he is a guy that most superstars are perimeter players, be it a guard mm-hmm. or a wing. Their attack starts from the perimeter, and he doesn't interfere with that, mm-hmm. and it's in LA, right? And if it's without LeBron, you get to be the main star off of the court, right? Because LeBron will be the main star off of the court far beyond the point where he's able to do it on the court, right? It's kind of like late career Kobe in the same respect of, like, you might be better, but this will never be your team.
Yeah.
And I think AD is the type of guy where he can flourish off of that perimeter guy, and not, like, get in the way of their touches, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. And when you combine that with the biggest team in the NBA in terms of marketability, I actually think it's a very – maybe this is my Lakers fandom exceptionalism, et cetera, talking, but I actually think that's a very appealing combination.
No, I'm not saying that I wouldn't bet on it. I'm saying to this point, Anthony Davis hasn't been that guy. Like, he hasn't been the guy that, you know, you hear – So, like, LeBron is somebody who you've heard, especially in his prime, guys wanted to play with, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of weird with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, because everybody hates those guys, but they seem to like each other.
Sure. How much of AD with that idea, how much of that was New Orleans?
See, that's where it's tough. I wish we would have known a little bit more clearly if DeMarcus Cousins doesn't get hurt, mm-hmm. right? Because, like, then Cousins had that decision to make. Apparently, Davis wanted him to stick around, right? I would imagine the Pelicans wanted him to stick around, too.
So, my understanding is that it was the Pelicans that didn't want to pay him the type of money that he would command. So that, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, and if that's the case, then that would have been the Pelicans' fault, right? So it is hard to say. They were such a joke of an organization. Like, that's why he left. So
right.
I don't, it's hard. It's always impossible, basically, to divvy up the blame pie for why superstars didn't go to play with Anthony Davis. He's just never to this point struck me as that player that you hear, so-and-so from... You know, Bradley Beal is really interested in one day playing with Anthony Davis. Like, even in hypothetical X, that was never something that we really heard about. Now, I do think, as you're saying, because he's a Laker, that's going to change over the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. Now, that's why I'm paying attention to those settings when other superstars are there, because that's where those conversations take place.
And we're talking about joining a 28-year-old Anthony Davis at the time in which people would be making this decision.
Right. Prime, that's still like Anthony Davis.
Smack in the middle of his prime, man. So I think there's appeal to that too.
Yeah. Boy, could you imagine how daunting a 28-year-old Anthony Davis and what would it be, like a 26, 25-year-old Giannis?
Yeah, man. And that's why, that would be a ton of fun. And that's what the Lakers are gearing toward. I'm skeptical, and especially after the last several failures at getting, LeBron being the exception. Like, I'll believe that when I see it. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, man, that would be so much fun.
What needs to happen is Giannis is assigned with Clutch. And then...
Bro, could you imagine? I would, even if he doesn't sign with the Lakers, I would pay a lot of money
just
for that to happen, just to see NBA Twitter lose their shit for God, that would be delicious.
All right, let's go. A couple more questions here. Assess the Threat writes, "Hey, Anthony and or Pete, are either of you into video games? If so, what kind of stuff do you enjoy playing? And if not, why?" I was actually surprised. I would have guessed that you weren't into video games. I answered this. I like a few games here and there. But you said you really liked video games once upon a time.
I did, and I still do. This is probably, I feel like I'm in confessional right now. Mm-hmm. So you know what I do most of the time? This is kind of embarrassing to admit, but when I'm in my, like, I don't want to work on this video right now, I need to kill a few minutes, there's a game on my phone called Clash Royale, which is like the Clash of Clans type.
Okay.
And it's like you play each other, you send out troops and try and destroy the towers on their side. Right. No, it's different than Command and Conquer. So I like Civilization, like Sid Meier's Civilization, but that's turn-based. It's very, very long, can take a couple of days to play a game, really. And you build up cities. I'm always big on like building up, you know, simulation games, things like that really appeal to me. But this damn game has me addicted, this Clash Royale game. And again, you try to like... knock down more of their towers than they knock down of yours.
Yeah.
And you got all these like creatures and characters that have different skills and ability. And I'm just so freaking addicted to this game that it's like, there's something about it that really appeals to me. But in terms of like conventional games, I always loved, you know, the sports video games. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it was more like simulation type of game. I was pretty good at like the fighter game, your Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter. I was okay at those, but the sports and the simulation games were always mine. What about you?
Well, so one of the things that it's kind of a bummer. So the video game nowadays is so online player versus player that unless you get into a game right when it starts, it's impossible to keep up. So, like, Fortnite, not even an option for me.
Right? Sure.
Overwatch, not an option.
Yes.
Destiny was an option for a really long time. I stopped playing it for a bit, the shooting game, and I tried playing the other day, and it was just, I was that dude stuck in the corner, it felt like, just getting shot, you know.
Sure.
So those games are kind of tough for me. And it's funny, look, I'm not going to judge you for your games, because the last few days, just to be, like, just for the calming effect, Red Dead Redemption 2, like, there's hunting and fishing and stuff like that. I've been really focused on the fishing, just because it's calming.
That's awesome. It's funny. So the last, like, console game that I was really into was Skyrim. You know, those Elder Scroll games? Mm-hmm. That was an awesome game, and I know they got the next one coming out, and I'll probably pick that up, but... Yeah, it's funny the way the things that we do to decompress. When you were talking about like Overwatch and Fortnite, and for me, there's not much appeal in playing a video game where there's a social component to it, right? Like where you're playing with yeah. other people online. Like for me, I'm like, I'm playing this video game to get away from you people. Like I don't want to hang out with y'all. Like I'm trying to re-energize so I can deal with y'all again.
Yeah, so. I literally do the fishing thing at like That's two great. Or three in the morning. Right after I fed Avery, you know, like just woosah, turn my brain off, zombie mm-hmm. walk to bed and fall into a coma. Let's go one more question here. This is the one I teased. I guess we kind of have to answer it seeing as I teased it. Money Mike H writes, what's up, man? So my question is, who would win in a best game series? So we'll say seven game series between the current Lakers and the 2010 Lakers. And then also the current Lakers versus your favorite Laker team or the best Laker team in your opinion. So we'll start with 2010. So like the 2010, like the Powell, and I know you hate Powell, you know, so you have... But how does this team match up against that team?
I think the 2010 team wins in five or six games, probably yeah. six games in Pretty a seven-game series. Yeah, AD is better than Powell, and wow. I'd say, you know, Kobe and this LeBron are close, right?
That Kobe was fun.
That Kobe was a lot of fun, yeah. right? The rest of that team in 2010 is way better than the yeah. rest of this team.
There's no
Odom. It's like 3 through 12. You had Lamar Odom, who mm-hmm. was not only was he good individually, that he fit really well with, and he was a good two-way player. Mm-hmm. He fit really well. Had Bynum starting, but usually not finishing. Usually it'd be Odom. Then you had solid, you know, D Fish was okay, you know, probably below average. But you had in 2010, you had Meta. The year before that, you had Ariza. You had Jordan Farmar coming off of the bench, Sasha Vujacic. These are bench guys. These are role yeah. player type of guys, but they were just solid, you know, like 1 through 9 or 10 in a way that once you get to 3 and below, the current team's Lakers counterparts just don't quite match up.
Yeah, I mean, it's why you and I harp so much on the margins. Because, like,
right.
that Brian Cook for Trevor Ariza move, like, I'm still waiting for Pelinka to pull that kind of a trade off, you know, where people it's a lot easier to look back at that deal and laugh now, but mm-hmm. a lot of Laker fans had no idea who Trevor Ariza was.
Sure.
Like, he was just like a semi-athletic. Well, no, he went to UCLA, right? So that kind of
but he wasn't like, he was a second round pick. He played with the yeah. Knicks, got traded to Orlando. We got, I think, did we get or did we trade Mo Evans in that deal? I feel like we got Mo Evans, and he was like considered to be the main guy, mm-hmm. right, of that trade. And Ariza was a throw-in.
Yeah.
And then it turned out like, whoa, yo, this kid can play.
Yeah.
And so I mean, the Lakers have had a couple, like Caruso might be one of those like wins on the margin, mm-hmm. right? But we haven't had a trade for sure where, yeah. you know, we trade for a guy and it's like, oh, that really worked out.
Yeah. And even Caruso, like they've got in their own way of finding out what Caruso is because he's played behind Tyler Ennis and Rajon Rondo. So,
right.
All right. This shouldn't even be asked. In my opinion, but the three-peat era Lakers against these Lakers is just ugly. It doesn't go well.
The only way that it would be competitive is I do think we've figured out basketball mm-hmm. better over the last 20 years in terms of the spacing concepts and like, can you transport a team from 2001 into 2019 and they win in the same manner? Probably not, right? Like we've figured out where the most efficient shots come from. If you're, you know, if you've got Horace Grant at the four or AC Green at the four in the modern era, you probably have some issues with your spacing. But if we're not, you know, convoluting it to that degree, then yeah, the three-peat team definitely wins.
Yeah. I mean, the Robert Horry team, I think, would give this team the most problems because that was the closest thing to a modern team, right?
That's like, a good point.
When they had that crazy comeback against the Trailblazers, that was four and out. That was four shooters around Shaq.
This is a great point. Robert Horry is one of the pioneers of the stretch four position. We think of like Sean Marion and those mid-2000 Suns teams, but that's what Horry was doing for hell, even going back. It's funny, Phil Jackson is so kind of like against the threes in modern NBA. You can go back to Tony Kukoc playing the four spot, and he kind of is stretch four-y, right? Could shoot from three, could pass the ball and handle it a bit. He benefited from him, Robert Horry, and Lamar Odom. Mm-hmm. So as much as Phil kind of bristles at that, he actually was one of the pioneers of using stretch four type of guys.
Maybe Phil knew that he was a pioneer, but wanted to bristle at it so that nobody else went there.
Ah,
light maybe. Years.
Light years indeed.
No, that was the three-peat era Lakers. I think that team is underrated at this point.
Huh.
I really do. Like I would put them against any team in the history of basketball. The 16-1 Lakers, was that an Horry year? Was that?
Yeah, all of them were Horry years. So Horry came off the bench for most of those teams. Mm-hmm. Then you had, in 2000, you had AC Green was the starter, Horace Grant in 2001, and I think Samaki Walker in 2002. Mm-hmm. But Horry was closing out games in each of those years.
Yeah, so give me that 16-1 Lakers team against any team in NBA history, and I like my chances. It's probably close. There's some teams that make it close or that they even lose to in a close series, but that's a really good team.
That's with that we're talking about peaks, right? Because that 2001 team, I think they were a 3 seed or a 4 seed or something like that.
Yeah.
But that playoff run, that is the best I've ever seen a team play.
Yeah.
Now, they didn't play like that the entire season.
No. That was maddening.
But when they hit that right. No, totally. But that 6 to 8 week stretch in the playoffs, some of the best. And they vanquished every early 2000s foe in order. Your Portland Trailblazers was who was contending in 2000. Kings. Crushed them. Mm-hmm. Then the Spurs. Mm-hmm. Or no, then the Kings. And then the Spurs, or do I have that backwards?
I don't know.
Either way, like all of their early 2000s opponents, those were the three teams, and they didn't just beat those teams. Those were like
swept.
Average margin of victory, like 18 points.
Yeah.
Right? That was your average game. And that Spurs team in particular, and I remember you, Popovich. I remember you, like, I remember these teams, how Popovich's teams don't give enough, and this, we could tie it all together with this. Popovich's teams don't get enough crap for giving up as often as they do and to the degree that they do. Mm-hmm. Bro, that Team USA game was 32-7.
Yep.
At one point, they fought back, so they didn't give up. But the just like not coming out or the folding, that's happened with a ton of Popovich teams.
Yep. Give me that 3-peat team against anybody, and I feel all right. Even these, like even last year's Warriors, like at their peak, healthy Durant, everything. Give me those Lakers, and I feel all right about it.
Those were fun squads, man.
All right. That'll do it for this episode and this week's episodes of the Locked On Lakers podcast. Thank you guys very much for tuning in the way that you have. Get your questions in for Sunday's mailbag that we'll be answering for Monday's show in the form of a 5-star review, and I guarantee we will get to them. But for now, have a great rest of your weekend. Make somebody else's, and we'll talk to you on Monday.